1-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Welcome to another delicious text message. I'm Nate Langson.
And I'm Ian Morris, in the middle of a slurp.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I did allude to the deliciousness just a moment ago.
Absolutely. I mean, we do love our hot drinks during a podcast, don't we?
So we do. We are fans of swallowing. And this week we are going to start by swallowing, or rather regurgitating, perhaps it should be said, some news from Mobile World Congress. Now, Ian, you were out at MWC.
I was.
This week. We're going to talk about a couple of things in detail this week. The first we're going to talk about is the LG G5. And then we're going to really touch upon what kind of stole the show to a lot of extents, which is VR, virtual reality. We're going to take a deep dive below the surface of not just the VR that was shown up at the show, but also some of the alternative uses for virtual reality, from medical applications, crime scene investigations, pornography, pain relief, PTSD. I mean, there's a lot we're going to get into in the second half. We've also got some emails. Ian, let's start with this aforementioned LG G5, the G5. Now, you've written in the show notes here, could it be the phone for 2016? Justify yourself, man.
Well, it could be, because they've decided to go down a new route of modularity, which I find quite exciting. The idea here is that you've got the bottom is removable, and in there is your battery, so you can switch batteries, and there's also the opportunity to add in different modules. So one leaked that's basically a camera grip, has a zoom wheel on it, and that's important, but we'll come to the cameras later, and has a button specifically for shooting video and a button for taking photos, so it's handy. It also has an extra battery built in, that one, so you get a bit more battery life if you're out shooting snaps all day. There's also a DAC, a much better quality DAC that they've developed.
Digital to analog converter, for those of you not au fait with audio terminology. That's the thing that turns things from zeros and ones in memory to physical, well, near physical vibrations for your ears.
Yes, and there's a much better one on offer from thanks to a partnership with Bang & Olufsen. Mm. And that's actually interesting as well, because you can use it with your computer as well. So you can plug it into a laptop. You could plug it into another phone. Doesn't have to be an LG. Just needs a USB connector and a device that supports USB audio.
So in terms of being the phone for 2016, is it just the fact that this is modular and that...
No, a lot of it really interests me. They've gone for a metal body. So that puts it in the same league as... you could argue in the same league as the iPhone. Of course, there are differences. I think... The thing that I've always loved about LG is that they always seem to think a little bit differently than everyone else. So while you could say that Samsung and Apple, and we all know that they both take ideas and inspiration from each other, I would say that LG obviously does a bit of that as well, but also always advances things with its own ideas. So it did a curved phone, and Samsung did as well, but it was never as good. You know, the LG Curve phone was always quite a nice handset to use. This year they had a V10, which had, it wasn't sold in the UK, but it had two front-facing cameras. One was a wide camera and one was a sort of normal selfie camera, which is actually a very clever idea. So, you know, for normal selfies, then you've got the normal camera. And for when you want to get loads of people in, you've got the wide camera. And they flipped that around on this one. So on the back, it's an 8-megapixel camera, which is wide angle. And then there's a normal 16-megapixel camera that just deals with the normal stuff. And the purpose of that is to sort of give you a... It just gives you a lot of options. You can zoom. You can use those two cameras at the same time. So you can have the normal camera forms a picture in the middle, and then you can have sort of frame it with a sort of blurred image of the wide-angle camera. Now, you know, none of this is going to change the world, but the idea is that there's flexibility there to sort of do different things and to make... they're just ideas that other people aren't using, and I kind of like that, and I respect it. Plus, the phone seems great. They've dropped the battery capacity slightly, which is a worry,
Yeah. But not by a huge amount. It's 2,800 to this
from 3,000. Yeah, and you know, it all makes a difference. So that's a slight worry. But they they do claim they've nailed the battery tech, and Android has a lot of features in the latest version that help enormously with battery tech.
Yeah, and we saw this with Samsung as well in one of the two S7 models. I think it was the Edge. The battery capacity has been lowered ever so slightly. But as you say, there's a lot going on the inside in terms of software that really determines how long your battery is going to last. I mean, one of the things the G5 has got that we haven't touched upon is that it has this always-on display on the front, which allows you to show information like if you've got a missed call, the time, do you have an email. And those sorts of things take a tiny, tiny little drip of the battery.
Well, here's the interesting statistic. Samsung reckons its always on screen uses about 1% of power per hour. And LG says it's got 0.8%. But crucially, LG actually switches off when it's in your pocket. So it uses the light sensor to detect when it's not needed and turns itself off. That's rather clever, isn't it?
It is rather clever. Now, I mean, you've made a good case that this is the interesting Android phone to look out for this year. It's not going to be cheap, we don't think.
We've
looked into
not.
Prices and release dates for the UK. It's going to launch probably in April. So if you've got a contract in the UK expiring around that time, then this is definitely one to keep in mind that's going to come out and is worth looking at. It's a flagship. So it's going to be, at the top end of the price range, you know, probably up there with the iPhone and the S7. And definitely I agree with you. And it's got, you know, in terms of what LG's trying to do, whether or not it's something that'll last and we'll see again in the next year's phone, you know, that's all to be determined. But there's a lot of interesting ideas here. I think the critical thing is going to be to put the cameras side by side and see which takes better pictures, because Samsung made a big play with the S7, pardon me, that it was going to be photography led as a device, you know, aside from the VR 360 thing. Its cameras are amazing. So it's going to be one that we're going to have to put side by side, which is very difficult to do in an audio podcast.
It is. But I mean, we could do it outside of the podcast and then report on the results.
Yes, and post them on the blog. Well, we will do that. And that's the LG G5 in very interesting to get the hands-on report. Now, let's stay on MWC. You were out there at the show this year. I didn't go this year for a variety of reasons. But what was the sense that you got from the show? Where was the excitement? And if you can do this by also mentioning VR, that would make it brilliant for the next segment.
Well, the excitement was all around VR, Nate.
Ah, good.
that is actually legitimately true. I think every show has a set of technologies, doesn't it, that ultimately end up being the thing that, you know, with CES, it always used to be a TV thing. It'd be 3D or something like that. Mobile World Congress is a little bit harder to predict, but of course, there are always trends, and VR is going to be the big thing this year.
The HTC Vive. This is something that I had a text from my brother Andy from CNET, who obviously has been on the podcast before, and he sent me a text saying something along the lines of, have you used the HTC Vive yet? It's game-changing, and I don't use that lightly.
Yeah, the Vive is something special.
So, since he's currently still out at Mobile World Congress, although I think he's currently driving a Tesla around the French town of Carcassonne as we speak, can you sort of sum up his opinions with your own opinions? Tell us, why are people going so nuts for HTC Vive?
Well, I didn't really see Andy at the show, to be honest. I saw a load of the other cool CNET people, but Andy was absent. We hooked up with Luke Westaway and Katie for lunch. It was very pleasant. But anyway, that aside, Vive is super, really, really super. What makes it interesting as a VR proposition is that it has this ability to allow you to move around a room. So you get with it this sensor, which you set up, and it communicates with the headset, so it knows where you are in the room.
Can you describe the sensor? Are we talking like
it's a small cube? Now, why don't we start with the downsides? Okay, the price I think isn't a massive downside. It's too expensive for most people, but that's fine. It's generation
one. It's announced. It's 700 quid, just
exactly. And of course, that's a huge sum of money, and you're going to have to spend at least that again to get a computer capable of really driving VR. In fact, I saw someone say that they reckoned you could get a VR-capable computer for about £600 or something, and I'm a bit dubious about that because I think, you know, the graphics card alone to drive a good VR experience is going to be between £300 and £500. So I would say you're going to be looking at something like a, well, ideally a 980 Ti, but who knows? People will be able to get... You'll be able to do things in VR on less powerful systems, but you won't be able to have that high-end AAA, whatever that turns out to be, experience, I suspect.
But what makes the Vive different then from the rest
right.
of it? Because they all kind of require the same thing.
Well, this Oculus. Is it. So yeah, exactly. The Vive comes with everything, which is interesting, because I don't think that's the case with all of them. You need this room tracker, so it's able to see where you are in the room, but you also get hand controllers, which enable you to sort of feel, if you will, in quotes, the environment you're in. And then, of course, there's the headset. So what HTC and Steam, Valve, have done is really make a product that's ready to go. So you could take it off the shelf, and as long as your computer's powerful enough, you are going to be able to set up and have a pretty amazing VR experience.
And this is done with Valve, the yes. the game developer and the maker of Steam, as yes. as a partnership. This isn't just tacked on bonus. It's something
no,
they've done
well,
together.
That aspect of it is sort of an unknown quantity at the moment. Obviously, Valve wanted VR, and I think that this is a very Valve-led project, but Valve's actual visible involvement in it is yet to be seen, really, because we don't know what they're going to release to support it.
It's all on the software side for Valve, so whatever's coming down the pipeline,
yeah, absolutely.
It's going to be, you know, I mean, it's the kind of thing where, just to throw some excitement out there, they'll announce Half-Life 3 in August, and it'll be an entirely VR-led experience
yes.
that you play using the Vive exclusively or something.
Although the guy from Valve told me that those games don't actually lend themselves at all well to VR. Now, I think there's probably a debate to be had about that. VR, especially with the Vive, is something where I think they sort of want you to be moving around in the environment. So the demo you get when you go and see it at a trade show, or if HTC shows it off, is you walk into a room. The room is just a normal room. There's furniture in it, as when I did it, at least. You put the headset on, and then you're encouraged to move around. And what's very clever about Vive is it has a camera built in. So in addition to this room sensor, you're able to program into that, or it does a lot of this automatically. It is able to sense where the room is, so it scans with a you know, some sort of laser that's invisible.
A bit like the Kinect, the Xbox Kinect.
Exactly. So it knows what's in your room, and it can see objects, and it can see obstructions. So what happens is, if you walk towards a wall, you get this wonderful sort of grid that appears in your VR view to give you an idea that you're coming towards a boundary, and that boundary could be a wall or it could be a chair, but the software is able to show you that, and it does that with the built-in camera as well. So if you turn it on, you're able to see things that are in the room. So but it's almost impossible to explain how it works in practice, but it's very clever. It doesn't just show you the camera, it shows you a sort of kind of a VR representation of what's in the room. So when I did the demo, there was a chair, and he said, oh, look, there's a chair, walk over to the chair and sit down. And I was like, well, are you sure? Am I not just going to end up on my ass? How can this be accurate enough for me to actually do that? And sure enough, you absolutely can. You can walk up to the chair, you can sit down, and there's no accidents. And it's absolutely brilliant. It is
wow.
perfectly designed, actually. It's really very clever. Yeah. And I think that's, for me, that's where Vive has this advantage over pretty much everything else. It's an all-in-one box. It is expensive, but it's also probably the best all-in-one package. Now, there are some technical things about it that they say make it technically the best as well, but without testing it next to, say, Oculus Rift, that's hard to judge.
Yes. I mean, you've kind of convinced me, because the tie-up with Steam and Valve is a big deal, because that's kind of what's going to get us the real software oomph that we need for something like
yeah.
this. I mean, the price, you know, anything like this, early adopter type stuff, it's always expensive. I mean, £700 is a lot, but, you know, people will spend that on a phone, and
yeah.
if the software support is there down the line, I don't think it's unrealistic to expect people to pay that. And I do like the idea that it is a complete package.
On the downside, of course, and it's only fair because I was going to do this at the beginning, the problems are fairly substantial in some regard. You're always cabled, for one thing, so you have to have a cable that runs from you to the computer.
So that's going to go away in version 2, obviously.
I would imagine so, but it's extremely difficult to send two 1080p images wirelessly in real time with no latency, and that's the issue, and that's why it hasn't been done. I think technically it's probably possible, but in terms of getting it down to no latency, that's near impossible. For now, I'm sure it will happen. Obviously, you have to wire in this sensor as well. I don't know if you get one or two sensors in the box. Certainly you get one. And again, that has to be, it's wireless, I believe, but it has to be powered. So it has to be plugged into the mains. So wherever, and you don't, it doesn't have to be particularly high, but it does have to be able to see your room. So that's quite important to remember. So those are little niggly things. By the time you put the whole thing on, it is quite a cumbersome experience. Like, there's quite a lot of stuff that you have to have, but it's brilliant. You can draw in 3D space and move around your drawing. And because you've got that positional stuff, it works flawlessly. It's superb.
And this is something I actually think was developed by Google. It's called It's called Tilt Brush.
Yes, that's exactly right. And it's phenomenal.
And you can draw, and then, and I remember Andy texting me about this bit as well. You can draw, and then you can sort of let you walk through your drawings. You can turn around them and see them from behind. Like some sort of ridiculous, well, not ridiculous, that sounds negative. Some kind of crazy, what am I trying to say here? Like when you get a sparkler on Bonfire Night and you can write your name or something and you can take a photo of it.
Yeah.
It's sort of like you could walk around that in real time. Wow.
Yes. I mean, it's a really nice experience. And of course, it's fun. And I think my kids will really love doing it. But also don't forget that has absolutely got real world practical applications that you can use, you know, from drawing a model of something you want to put in your lounge, you know, or, you know, fiddling around with a car design or something like that. There are really so many applications for it. And we're at the point now where VR's like it actually is a thing that could be used for, you know, and feels immersive. It's not so cumbersome now that it's annoying.
No. Well, this is going to go for pre-order on the 29th of February, which I believe is Monday, which is when most people will probably start to hear this podcast. You will, for £689, you get the wireless controllers, you get the movement sensor for the room, you get the head-mounted display, and you get the three software titles. One thing that's quite interesting is that you can, I believe, receive calls and texts and things through it. So you're not completely separated from the real world, which I think is quite interesting.
Can be a bit of a problem with virtual reality, and it's one of the things that when you're doing it, you kind of do feel a bit weird about. And if someone comes in when you're doing it and taps you on the shoulder, you'll get the scarier life. So
that's true.
But again, HTC can solve that particular problem by keeping you aware of what's happening around you.
I wanted to really take a look at some of the other uses for VR. Now, there was one example I'm going to get to just briefly to begin with, because a lot of our fellow journalists, including Sebastian Anthony on Ars Technica UK, who tried this. This was pornography. It's a very weird thing to experience at a press conference, I can only imagine.
I think it sounds absolutely horrendous.
Yeah, well, Sebastian gave a write-up about his experience with VR porn and a company called Naughty America that I think he said in his piece had about 30 VR titles. I'm gonna go through a bit of his article here just to read out some highlights from what he said. Don't worry, you don't need to switch this off if you have particularly young kids. we're not going to be graphic or rude about any of this. So Sebastian writes, you'll be unsurprised to hear VR porn is awesome. It's like porn, but better. He talked about being able to look at the actor's body from the actor's head. So the actor obviously had a camera strapped to his head, and talks about that things do feel like they stick at you and fly at you. He sat there for quite a long time. Sometimes he was sort of a passive observer in the scene. Sometimes the actor was quite actively involved, and he got a bird's eye view, so to speak, of that. I'll quote him exactly on here. He says, "To be honest, it was a bit weird looking down and see someone else's body, but after a few minutes of watching, I began to feel a sense of agency. I began to feel that, yes, those rippling muscles were mine. I began to feel that it was me being tended to by two other beautiful people. And of course, just as I was starting to get into it, the demo ended, and I found myself back in the real world being grinned at by a couple of guys from Naughty America. Pretty cool, eh?" he said. "All I can do is nod. Why did the demo have to end so soon?" So if you do want to read a slightly more descriptive write-up of that experience, do go to arstechnica.co.uk and have a look at Sebastian's write-up. It is an entertaining read. And, you know, pornography has a history of driving adoption of technologies, you know, most notably in the Betamax versus VHS debate back in the late 80s. That was something that the porn industry had a hand in. And to a certain extent as well, the Blu-ray and HD DVD battle a little while after that as well. But let's move away from the obviously curious sides of VR. Let's look at another one. So I found an example of something called the VR Chair Traveler, which is essentially virtual tourism for people who have maybe locked-in syndrome, you know, ALS, motor neuron disease, or limiting conditions. It's an idea of being able to sell these virtual tourism experiences to people who are physically unable to get to any of these environments. And a bit more digging around this, found like quite a number of other examples of how virtual reality is being used to help people who have physical either impairments or problems. A real one that seems to be around for quite a long time is for post-traumatic stress syndrome, fear, phobias, and things like that. I found a company called First Hand that has actually been developing software for virtual reality for education and therapy services and similar tools since 1995, so that's over 20 years. And they've now got, there's now another company that I think is either an offshoot of that original company or founded by the same people, called Dreamstream VR. And according to a TechCrunch report I read, early versions of the Oculus Rift headsets were used to offer users pain relief, and that there are quite a lot of examples to show that it's VR is actually a much safer means of relieving people from pain than just pumping them full of drugs. There was another report on the same topic from Wired that said Howard Rose, who spent the last 20 years working on these tools, he said that his company had developed something called Spiderworld, which was an application to treat people with arachnophobia. There was another one as well called Iraq World, and I think a similar one called Afghanistan World, which sounds maybe quite fun, but actually were used to treat soldiers with post-traumatic stress syndrome when they came back from fighting in Iraq. And the tools were a better way of immersing people in experiences that maybe they'd been in before, but needed to be coached or talked through in order to start dealing with some of these symptoms that they had. But there was another one that I saw from this company called Snow World, which is a first-person action game designed to help burn victims manage their pain. And this was done in conjunction with the University of Washington. And apparently, some of the researchers working on this have been using the game to help distract patients from their pain for years now. And they've started doing a lot more with this technology as part of this Deepstream VR startup based out of San Francisco. So it's really interesting how these tools, because they're so immersive, can A, stimulate people's responses based on experiences they've had in the past that may have been extremely traumatic, but allow them to be so feel like they're so immersed in it that they can actually be treated for it in real time, which I think is just, you know, it's just absolutely fascinating. Would you agree?
Yeah, I absolutely would. I think it's really good, and I think it's amazing just how much of an impact something like that can have. But I suppose it makes perfect sense if you think about it. You know, the probably one of the worst things about having any illness that maybe restricts where you can go is the fact that you feel like you're missing out on stuff. And if you can experience that through VR, then you no longer feel like you're missing out, do you? So it makes sense. And the idea of using it for pain relief is spectacular. I mean, I love the fact that they've put so much research into it already. It's obviously, VR is obviously going to come from all angles this year, I suspect. It's going to be used quite extensively.
Well, there's another one that I found extremely interesting here. I mean, I read a few different... I read about a number of companies that have been working on things with phobias. There were some to do with agoraphobia or people who are afraid of heights, or, you know, that needed to overcome those fears because their job, ironically, meant that they had to work at heights or what have you. But there were a number that seemed to stand out for fear of flying, which is something that a lot of people have to do and a lot of people are very scared about doing. And there's an interesting patent that I found filed a couple of years ago from the company Airbus, which is obviously one of the biggest airline manufacturers in the world, that has patented a system that shows passengers wearing virtual reality headsets in flight as a way of removing them from the feeling that they were in a flight situation. So, you know, effectively something along the lines of they're flying on the back of an eagle through a desert instead of flying in a giant compressed tube over the Atlantic. I mean, is that something that you would ever consider using, Ian?
Well, I mean, I'm not afraid of heights particularly or anything that I'd want to have treated like that.
Well, this is specifically flying.
Yeah.
You know, this is the idea of being in a situation where you're physically terrified and these experiences are so immersive that they can remove you, at least in some part, from being... feeling afraid.
And of course that is probably one of the only accepted ways of curing phobias is to have exposure in varying amounts, and then as you get used to it the phobia sort of goes away slightly. The only thing I really wouldn't want to be exposed to is a spider, and I can see that being used in VR as well to do the same thing. But
yeah, well, that's what the what did I say it was called, the Spider World, that was done, Howard Rose, firsthand.
Yeah.
And that was developed specifically for treating arachnophobia.
I mean, my arachnophobia is not particularly crippling. I can get rid of any spider in the house. It's just that I wouldn't want to encounter some of the spiders that exist in some of the parts of the world. I'm looking at you, Australia.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the comments I read from one of the researchers actually during this is that, you know, they've been researching this stuff for years, decades, in fact, in the case of some. But the problem is that because the equipment's been so expensive and so difficult to acquire for such a long period of time, that it's only ever been used to treat really extreme acute cases of either phobias or PTSD for, you know, people coming back from horrific scenes in war. And so there's a degree of excitement that because the technology is being made so much more affordable, that actually this is something that doctors will be able to get their hands on and explore for much, I don't want to say less severe, because, you know, anxiety or fear or anything is very severe to anybody, but it's something that could say, well, we can now develop things that are going to be much more widely accepted in doctor surgeries or in hospitals without having to justify spending huge amounts of money to treat only the most severe of cases, which I thought was, you know, just a fantastically exciting way. You know, so many people suffer, you know, even from anxiety disorders. This is the kind of thing that could really help.
You can apparently VR cuddling of children is helping people with depression. You know, it's there's so much obviously already happening in terms of what this technology might offer in the future that I was excited about it from an entertainment point of view. When you start putting science into it, it becomes even more exciting. Like I was really chuffed to be able to basically stand on the surface of Mars and have a look around, because I'm never going to get to have that experience in my actual life.
So, well, you say that, you never know, but I know what you mean.
For people who, you know, love a bit of science and especially love space, it is the opportunity to really explore things. There is a fantastic VR solar system tour that I play all the time when I borrow a Gear VR from Samsung. It's just superb. Titans of Space, I think it's called. And it's just fantastic. So good. You know, just one of those experiences that, you know, actually feels like you're experiencing something game-changing.
Well, on the topic of space still, did you know, because I didn't know this before doing this research either, that NASA used VR in a room to help astronauts train for correcting a mission in 1993 aboard the Hubble Space Telescope.
That's insane.
NASA's been using VR for about two decades on a range of projects, basically enabling astronauts to get used to making fixes for things where they're having to rely on talking to other colleagues who may have a slightly different perception of what is up or down. And one of the first ones that seems to have been documented, and this was in a great article on Tech Republic, which I strongly recommend anybody who's interested in this go and read. It was written by Erin Carson, techrepublic.com. And the one of the examples that was in this piece was that when the Hubble Space Telescope was launched in 1990, it actually had an error on the mirror inside it, and they had to go up and fix it and fix this mirror in order to correct the issue. And part of the training for this mission was done using virtual reality, which I thought was amazing.
I mean, it makes sense in a lot of ways, doesn't it? Because what you need to do with any mission in space or anything like that is, it's about precision, isn't it? And the only way you can get to precision is by rehearsing over and over again and just making sure that you understand the sequence of things that you have to do to make something work. And, you know, you're talking about a mission there that, if it had failed, that would have rendered hundreds of millions of dollars worth of equipment completely useless. So, you know, that makes sense. And I think we're going to see a lot of stuff like that. You know, surgeons are going to be using VR to practice operations, and they'll be able to.
They already are.
Yeah,
they already are.
But it will get cheaper, and it will almost certainly have a huge impact on death rates, and mean that people will, you know, have much greater chance of surviving operations.
Definitely. Well, I mean, just a couple of others that I found interesting. We've talked about this for quite a while, but I found some great examples of how it was being used to train sports players. There's a company called StriVR, STRIVR, which is a technology company that had worked with a US sports team to help the players learn how to basically make snap decisions, I think, for want of a better term. There's an example in this article I found. Stanford quarterback, I have no idea what a quarterback does, but I assume that's quite an important role.
Stand at the back somewhere in the last, I don't know, quarter or something, but no idea.
Well, I assume it's something to do with passing, because a quote from this article said that after using the VR headset before games, he was completing 10% more passes, and the team boosted its average game score from 24 to 38. And so, you know, this particular quarterback who was interviewed said that the VR practice was invaluable. Which
I can tell
amazing.
You that 38 is more than 24.
It is.
So, I mean, that's got to be good, right? I assume.
I assume so.
I hope no one in the US listens to this, because I mean, I don't know much about football, but I really don't know anything about American football.
No, Ian and I are not exactly very well versed in the sports world, and I'm sure we'll have a number of listeners write in to tell us what quarterbacks do. But don't worry. In fact, don't bother, because
because I could Google it if I cared. I'll be honest.
But it's great. I mean, this is just one example. This is happening all over the world, and I think anything that can increase sports players' abilities like that, you know, is obviously in the world of sport incredibly important.
It's been quite well known for a long time, hasn't it? That you can rehearse things. So if you want to do something well, a physical activity, you can play through it in your mind, and that helps, apparently. It's almost like practicing it for real.
Well, Bloomberg did this, actually. We had a VR system for helping people prepare for talks.
Interesting. So to get rid of the sort of the stage fright aspect of it and things like that.
Yeah, you could put on the headset and you could see the room that you're going to be speaking in, like literally the room at the Bloomberg office, and you could put on the VR, give your talk with a virtual audience, and to try and sort of get used to giving the talks. And I didn't see any of this firsthand, but I think it would let you know, like via an app, if you were pausing a lot or saying or...
Very
clever.
All they need now is to tie that into some AI that understands humour and things like that, and can listen to what you're actually saying and then give you a report at the end. You know, that was funny. We predict that people would be 75% engaged in what you were saying, and that would be amazing.
Well, hopefully they don't apply that to podcasting, because we have a fantastic audience that is very able to tell us whether or not we've done a good job. There were some other topics I could get into here, but we've gone on for such a long time, and to be honest, a lot of these have such large medical applications. They do have medical applications, but there are lots of benefits to this. But VR has been used to help rehabilitate stroke patients, children with very severe cases of autism. There are a lot of these, and obviously fear of flying is one. The stuff about motor neuron disease we mentioned earlier. You know, I don't want to sort of validate and qualify how good or successful these are, but these are all things that exist, and I encourage anyone who's listening, if you've either had experiences of these or know about them or just, you know, want to go out and do a lot more research about it, you know, we'd love to hear about sort of how good these are and how effective they are. But either way, there's, because of the sheer number of the devices coming on sale now, the price of these things is coming down so much that hopefully we're going to just get more research taking place to make any of these remedies using VR better, more widely available, and ultimately more successful at healing patients and entertaining us, or arousing us in the case of Sebastian's porn story. But let us know any of your thoughts, or if we've missed out any that you think would be interesting. We're always happy to re-explore this topic because it's fascinating. podcast@natelangson.com. Okay, it's time to talk about email. Specifically, we're going to talk about
not the protocol, emails. Presumably.
No, not the email protocol, Ian, the antiquated protocol. No, we are going to talk specifically about two emails. The first one has come in from Rob. Rob says, "Hi, Nate slash Ian. A couple of points in relation to the conversation about three ad blocking this week. First off, Ian's assertion that advertising isn't really that bad and doesn't have much of an impact on bandwidth. It reminded me of this article, and he sent us a link to an article about the webpage The Verge. He says, this guy does a test on the blog of content being served up from The Verge. The main page came in at 12 megabytes. 7 megabytes of that was JavaScript. 1.3 meg is CSS. 1 megabyte is images. 700k is HTML. And I should interject there that 7 meg of JavaScript does seem like, you know, that's ads and things, because a megabyte of images does not seem very much. In this example, Rob continues, there's an awful lot of crap on the site. Ian's statement that ad delivery networks do need looking at, but it's not that bad, I think that's a long way from reality. Secondly, Rob continues, in reference to the part of the conversation about how everything is currently ad-sponsored and consumers need to realize this and stop getting stuff free by blocking ads. I work for a technology company. For most of its existence, we've sold servers to customers to install in their data centers. But now Amazon has come along with its cloud services and customers have found a different way of getting what they want. We have had to adapt and change our products with varying success. The correlation I'm trying to make here is that for a long time we ignored this new cloud thing because it didn't fit our products, Rob says. We were no longer making what our customers wanted and they found different ways to consume and pay for technology. I think something similar is happening to the web. For a long time, advertised supported content has been a good way of delivering content to readers. However, the balance between content and advertising and the intrusive nature of the advertising is disenfranchising users. I would draw a distinction between readers not wanting to pay for content and getting it for free and readers wanting to dodge intrusive advertising. Maybe something like Google Contributor might be the answer. Maybe not that specific product, but that kind of idea. That, Rob was suggesting, is something where Google allows you to sort of make these tiny little micropayments on websites that support it, and the ads disappear. It's actually not available in the UK yet, unfortunately, but I did have a look to see that. You can go to google.com/contributor to look into the details, because I hadn't really heard much about this. Finally, Rob concludes, I honestly don't think readers want stuff for free, and I think they are prepared to be shown adverts or to pay for content directly. But the current situation with awful intrusive advertising isn't a viable position going forward. That's a great email, Rob. Really enjoyed that, and I think some really salient points there. But, you know, I think that the nub of this is companies have to adapt, and if you don't adapt and change based on what customers want, then you're going to get shot in the foot. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing a bit.
I think that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. I think everyone who works in our industry understands that, you know, advertising is not going to last forever and it won't be able to support every site out there. Page weight's a huge issue. It was a huge issue when I used to work at the BBC years ago developing stuff and used to get a proper telling off if you weren't underweight for pages. But there's a lot going on like that. Why is that JavaScript on The Verge taking up 7 megs? That's ridiculous.
JavaScript could be anything. I mean, 7 megabytes of JavaScript.
I know CSS can take up a lot because obviously it may be switching in and out images and stuff like that. And so it's hard to judge, isn't it, really? Because it could be containing any manner of things.
But one 12 megabyte page is a hell of a lot.
It is a lot, and I've railed against this because you see people these days just don't get it. They're using animated GIFs. Animated GIFs are literally the most ineffective compression system for moving images you could ever imagine. The thing was developed like 30 years ago.
It is.
I mean, crap.
Yeah, they're a sequence of actually quite high res, badly compressed images almost.
High res in a completely useless way, not in a really good way.
There's several megabytes each, several megabytes per GIF. Let's not forget that.
BuzzFeed and did a thing, and it blew my mind. I mean, sometimes they're okay, but sometimes you get these pages, and people don't realize that, and they don't want to realize that. Like, people don't want to think about how much data they're downloading.
No, but there's a lot that can be done on the server side for that without blocking ads. I mean, this is the kind of thing that Opera did very well. In fact, Opera's just been bought by a Chinese company, and Opera Mini was one of the forerunners to modern mobile browsing back at sort of, it seemed to be at its heyday around the N95, the Nokia N95 era, because it would compress stuff at the server side before sending it to you and dramatically reduce the length of time it took to download web pages because it was compressing it before the mobile network got it. We haven't needed to use that because 3G and 4G has increased so much, but that's now what we're seeing be exploited to a certain extent by ad networks because they're not thinking that much about the efficiency of their ads. They're just thinking about getting the ads out to people. We could go down a rabbit hole and talk about this.
That was a really good email.
Rob, thank you ever so much. Well, Ian, that's going to wrap it up for this week, I believe. Thank you for jaunting out to Barcelona.
Oh, no worries. It was my pleasure.
I assume you've got some write-ups on Forbes for people.
I do, and there will be more as well. I had some very interesting chats about 5G, so we should talk about that one week, because 5G won't be around for a few years, but when it arrives, it will be revolutionary, I think.
Yeah, well, this Mobile World Congress was the first year I saw the term 4.5G bandied about.
Yes.
I have thoughts on that too. Well, maybe
Qualcomm's got some wicked tech, actually, that's gonna make a huge difference to, and we'll theoretically have some gigabit speeds quite soon.
Well, that's
in theory.
That's a tease for everybody. We'll double the bit rate of the podcast.
Yes.
We'll go all the way to 256 kilobits per second.
Amazing. Now,
we'll come back to that. Thank you to everyone who's been leaving reviews on the iTunes stores around the world. I mean, we're well over 120, I think now, 5-star reviews just on the UK store alone. Please keep them coming. Cannot tell you how much that benefits us. So if you listen to the show, if you enjoy it, if you think somebody else might like it, tell a friend, tell a colleague, help them install a podcast app and get them subscribed to Text Message. And
no need for an ad blocker on this show. Hey, Nate.
Well, don't need any ad blockers when there's no ads.
Yeah, exactly. That was my point.
Oh, I see. Sorry. Yes, but leave those reviews. And we'll see you guys in another week.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.